This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. In 2008, season 5 of The L Word premiered with the character Tasha, a decorated Iraq War veteran being investigated under Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
This is really stupid. We should just tell them they're our friends.
Tell us what?
Tasha's being held back because she's being investigated for homosexual conduct. And she has to keep a low profile, so if you could just lay off the PDA.
Thousands of LGBTQ veterans faced similar experiences before Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed in 2011 by President Obama. During a virtual White House event on Monday, the Department of Veterans Affairs issued new guidance to provide full benefits to veterans who were discharged because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Here's Kayla Williams, an assistant to the VA secretary. During the event, she spoke about her experience of being forced to hide her sexuality while serving in the Army. Then she announced the new guidance.
The VA adjudicators should clarify that service members who have an other than honorable discharge due solely to their sexual orientation, gender identity, or HIV status should be considered veterans who may be eligible for VA benefits, including disability compensation and burial.
Now, LGBTQ veterans who were other than honorably discharged are newly eligible for benefits from the VA, like healthcare, pensions, housing assistance, homeless assistance programs, and a proper veterans burial benefits. All these vital aspects of civilian life have been out of reach to thousands of queer veterans until now. Jennifer Dane is the CEO and Executive Director of the Modern Military Association of America. Welcome to The Takeaway, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
And Richard Brookshire is the Board Chair and Co-Founder of the Black Veterans Project. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Hi, I'm really excited for the conversation.
So, Richard, I want to start with a question that I feel like has been posed to Black folks and by Black folks to other Black folks really since the founding of the nation. And it is, why did you want to serve in the military?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. But for me personally, because I think it differs for everybody, I served because I lost my scholarship to college. Barack Obama had just become president. So I was young and impressionable and felt like no better time to serve than under a Black president. And I wanted money to pay for school. I think economic motivations are a large component of why so many working class people choose to don the uniform. So those are my personal reasons.
So, Richard, that's so helpful. And I think, in fact, you know, data and statistics, you know, bear that out, that when we look at our current volunteer military, that in fact, those questions of economic need and concern means that we have a much more working class military, you know, than our overall population, where folks, you know, with more wealth don't have to serve. So, Jennifer, can you then talk to me about the ways that we draw working class kids in, and then for LGBTQ young people who serve, they then don't get those benefits on the backside?
Absolutely. So I think the draw is, you know, the accessibility that they and the equity that they gain from serving. I mean, you have the opportunity to get education and housing and see the world. So I think the working class sees that as an opportunity to get out there and do more. And also the commitment to service. I think that's a huge thing of giving back to their country. Most folks, especially even me, I'm a veteran myself, and it's from a very small town. And the draw of just being part of something larger was a huge reason for me to join the military. For LGBTQ folks, an interesting statistic is the Department of Defense is the number one employer of transgender individuals. Most folks don't know that, but I think the draw is also pretty similar. You know, we face a lot of discrimination from, hopefully not so much now, but at least whenever I was growing up, from our communities, and especially in smaller towns that are usually more conservative. So the draw is just being able to be yourself, but being able to also give back. And the benefits, it's a hard topic. It's near and dear to my heart. And we're hoping to rectify that, because we know that that is a huge, huge stumbling block in our historical narrative of service for LGBTQ individuals.
Richard, the VA has said that they were working to, quote, reverse the harm done to more than 14,000 LGBTQ plus veterans who were discharged under almost 20 years of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. When you think about that, reversing the harm done. What does that mean for you? What would that look like?
Reversing the harm done. Well, I mean, first, there's about 100,000 people that are still alive walking around the United States that have been discharged for their gender identity or sexual orientation throughout, you know, the history of the military as it stands now. So, I mean, it's not sufficient to just focus exclusively on those that were discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, though I think it's a step in the right direction. I also think that the VA has very antiquated policies, right? So what was announced was that essentially an announcement to encourage LGBT individuals who had gotten other than honorable discharges to go through the process of attempting to get VA benefits. That is not the easiest thing for a lot of individuals to do. They have to file the paperwork. They have to kind of go through the hoops there. And then, you know, as an LGBTQ individual, thankfully I wasn't discharged under that policy, though I served under it. And it changed on my birthday when I was in Afghanistan, so symbolic in that way. Mm. I'm going through my disability process now, and it's quite antiquated, and it's lengthy, and it's there are complications that happen all the time. And so the VA is an imperfect system, and it certainly needs a lot of work. And I think lastly, one of the things that I think a lot of people don't recognize either is that there's a racial component even to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell crisis that transpired, the witch hunt that it was. And minorities were disproportionately affected. Women were disproportionately affected under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And so these groups already have major barriers to access when it comes to the VA, access to the full breadth of their VA benefits. And so the VA has to have a policy that's intersectional if they want to actually be able to not only foster trust amongst the LGBTQ community, but specifically Black LGBTQ people, which obviously I'm part of the Black Veterans Project. That's my purview. So, yeah.
So that's so helpful, Richard, both in terms of thinking about what this new guidance actually means, as well as drawing our attention to that intersectionality. Jennifer, so I feel like it's been reported primarily in a way that seems like, okay, you know, now open your mailbox and don't worry, you know, your benefits will be in there. I know they're not all mailbox benefits. I get that. But it feels like, oh, now it's automatic. But to hear from Richard that you now have to still walk through this process, what is that going to mean for actually being able to access these benefits?
Yeah, so that's one of the main questions we asked the VA yesterday. It was in a legislative hearing to really understand what that looks like. Because like Richard said, we know that there's over 114,000 veterans from World War II until the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 2011 that still don't have any benefits. 114,000. And those folks who served in silence, and some openly, and they served their country with dignity and respect, and we still haven't given them the respect that they deserve. And what they told us is, I do have to applaud the VA because they are heading in the right direction. And I do applaud them for taking this first step. But most of the folks were discharged either dishonorably or other than honorably or even bad conduct. So it only impacts a small amount of folks. And one thing that I really asked them to consider was was a policy called blue discharges. And those discharges were primarily given to those that were of the Black community, LGBTQ and Jewish. And those were just general discharges basically to push them out of the military. So, I mean, this history goes all the way back. And even an unknown fact that most people don't know is the first person ever discharged from the military for being gay was during the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. But to get back to your question, we would love to see them reach out because our organization does help with legal assistance and upgrading those discharges and getting the benefits restored. This policy does not upgrade discharges. It simply reviews the benefits and hopefully gets them reinstated. But the process, like Richard said, takes a very long time. We know that what we are seeing is anywhere from 2 to 10+ years. And that's just from the beginning of the process. And with the pandemic, we also saw that the National Archives were closed and also the Board of Records Corrections were closed. And so there's significant barriers. And you're talking about people that they need healthcare. They need a place to go, especially during a pandemic, and they don't have a place. I had a family that called and said, we just want burial benefits. And I said, I would love to help you restore those, but it's going to take a minimum of 2.5 years. And it's heartbreaking. And people should know that these folks served and they should be given all the dignity and honor that they deserve.
Absolutely. And it means so much to veteran families to have those burial rights and benefits for, I don't know, for folks who don't have veterans in their family, mm-hmm. may not understand the level of emotion and connection that there is to that particular honor, even beyond all of the other meaningful aspects of these resources that are meant to be made available to our veterans while they are living. Richard, I want to come to you as I'm hearing Jennifer and you talk about both your own experiences as well as reflecting on these kind of disproportionate numbers. Again, so often we've heard that the U.S. military was one of the first spaces of racial integration. It's been held up by various communities as a model of sort of, you know, the one institution in America that worked right around race. What do we misunderstand when we give that narrative?
I guess we misunderstand the facts, which is part of why Black Veterans Project exists, is that there are actually really stark racial disparities across the military at all levels, you know, from recruitment to retirement, from promotions to the military's justice system. Black people are marginalized at all levels. And, you know, part of what we're attempting to do at BVP is bring light to that, share those stories, you know, force the military to release data that it has tracking around even just present day racial inequities. For instance, there's a biannual racial equity climate survey that the DOD administers. It's only released 1 year of that data. Our advocacy helped to do that, but they've been collecting it for well over almost a decade now. So we want access to all of that data, because the data, you know, that did come out from that 1 year, 2017, was quite damning. It said that, you know, one in every three service members had witnessed white nationalism in the ranks. It said that, you know, somewhere around 50% of Black service members did, or minority service members, didn't feel comfortable reporting issues of discrimination. Like, so it, I mean, it said for fear of retribution. So, I mean, just these kinds of statistics, and to have them on paper to legitimize what a lot of Black service members are actually speaking about. But our main focus, our central focus, has been looking at the Department of Veteran Affairs and looking at racial inequities writ large across the Department of Veteran Affairs. So in the months to come, we're actually working on a deep media collaboration investigative report around historical benefit obstruction by the VA and its culpability there.
Jennifer Dane is the CEO and Executive Director of the Modern Military Association of America, and Richard Brookshire is the Board Chair and Co-Founder of the Black Veterans Project. Thank you both for your service and for your continued work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There has been a surge in cases of measles and diarrhea. Almost 50% of children are at risk of malnutrition, the resurgence of polio is a major risk, and 2.1 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine remain unused. 2,000 medical doctors and 1,500 registered nurses have left the country, and 600 private pharmacies have closed. Unless urgent action is taken, Afghanistan faces an imminent humanitarian catastrophe.
That's the Director General of the World Health Organization speaking this morning after the organization's return from a trip to Afghanistan. Public health experts and international aid organizations are warning that the healthcare system in Afghanistan is in danger of imminent collapse. The World Bank, the European Union, and other major international donors halted their donations to Afghanistan after the Taliban took control of the country last month. The sudden loss of hundreds of millions of dollars could leave the war-battered nation with staffing and supply shortages. More than 500,000 Afghans have been displaced by the conflict. COVID-19 infections are rising rapidly, and healthcare facilities in nearly every province are closing. Joining me now, is Deepmala Mehala, Vice President of Humanitarian Affairs for CARE, an international humanitarian organization fighting global poverty and world hunger. Deepmala, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa. Pleased to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit? We heard there from the WHO, but can you say a bit about what is happening on the ground even as we speak?
The situation, Melissa, is nothing short of dire. And let's remember, the situation in Afghanistan, the humanitarian crisis, it did not happen on 15th of August. We are talking of communities which have been facing war for four decades. There are children who have known that the only way of growing up is in the middle of war, destruction, and being forced to flee from their homes. So amidst other things, the health system is really in an inadequate shape. Supplies are running out, fuel shortage is there, the cold chain is being compromised. The healthcare workers, they have not received the salaries, medicines are in shortage. So the healthcare delivery system is on the brink. And out of a country of 39 million people, at least 18.4 million are in need of humanitarian assistance. And as we speak, Melissa, 1 million children are at the risk of falling into severe acute malnutrition. So it is all very linked, and it's a catastrophe which the world has watched grow and deteriorate. The needs are only rising.
It's very helpful to hear you provide that longer timeline. I suppose I've been thinking, was this something that could have been predicted, this sort of swift collapse of the healthcare system? But what I hear you saying is that it isn't necessarily swift. It's just that it's become more acute in recent weeks.
Absolutely. In the recent week, the existing humanitarian crisis has been exacerbated. And of course, we are talking about the health system. There are also high food insecurity. Millions of people are going hungry. So when people wake up in the morning, several of them have no idea where they will get food from, or forget about where. Will they get food at all? Will they have safe water to drink? Will they have a safe place to sleep? And when people are forced to flee and displaced, just think about it. Why would somebody run out of their homes in ambiguity, uncertainty, amidst insecurity? Because that journey seems safer than their own home. So yes, the humanitarian agencies have been predicting the deterioration, for example, in the food security situation, in the rising projected numbers of people needing humanitarian assistance has been there. So it is not something which has happened overnight. We could have prepared and responded better, but now, there's no time for words, empty words. That time is long gone. Time to act, everybody together right now. There's too much at stake.
Okay, so let's talk about what can happen. I hear you saying empty words are insufficient, not enough. We don't have time for that. Talk to me a bit about what would be relevant. What are the kinds of interventions that are needed?
Absolutely. So what we need right now is, as we say, all hands on deck. So when we are talking of health system, it is related to food insecurity. Children who are into severe malnutrition, they need hospitalization. We are hearing from our partners on the ground, our colleagues, our teams. CARE has about 500 staff on the ground. There are children with whatever is left of hospitals. If you would give your hand to them, they would not be able to grasp it because they are so weak. So poverty, drought, COVID-19, food insecurity, malnutrition, it all is coming together. However, we have great lessons where humanitarian assistance has quickly averted or changed the course of a catastrophe. So continued and sustained funding support to Afghanistan is really important, because I often worry once the headlines fade, people's attention also deteriorates. This is something which will need some concerted efforts over the coming few years.
It's my understanding that at least part of what is happening in these sort of intersections of failing, collapsing healthcare, as you've talked about, is also other infrastructure problems, right? So the idea that that those COVID-19 vaccines are sitting there but are unused, that isn't about sort of just an unwillingness to distribute those vaccines, but that there is a real problem with the infrastructure to make it possible to get them to people.
Absolutely. For a successful humanitarian response, smooth supply chain and logistics are the backbone. So 1 out of 4 hospitals that can treat COVID-19 have been closed only in the recent weeks. So then there are the issue of fuel shortage. The banking system, it is opening up, but it is not fully functional. So when there is not an efficient and smoothly running banking system, when fuel is short, this really hampers. And then when fuel is not there, electricity gaps are there, then the cold chain suffers. So with all these multiplied complexities, the health system, the COVID response really gets very compromised.
Dimala, can you talk to me a bit about how organizations like CARE, Doctors Without Borders, and other international aid organizations, sort of what are the circumstances even for your workers right now Afghanistan?
The circumstances are uncertain, but the organizations like CARE and the others that you named, CARE has been there since 1961, way before, you know, several of us were even born. That means we have strong relationship with the communities. We know the context, we know the area, we know the people, and over 98% of our staff are from Afghanistan, not only from that country, but from area. So that gives us a strong understanding of what exactly the gap and need are. So it is very much possible. It is very, very much possible to respond to the humanitarian needs. CARE, after a brief pause, we have resumed our activities, but we need several enablers. And some of the main enablers are funding, which is flexible, which is for emergency response and longer term. The banking system to be fully operational. Other infrastructure facilities like fuel and electricity to be there. And the most important thing, smooth, uninterrupted, and safe humanitarian access. If aid workers are not safe, if aid workers are not able to reach, aid work by definition depends on aid workers. So if all these enablers are in place, agencies like CARE can operate. We have been operating. We have resumed our activities. For example, earlier this week, our teams were working in one of the provinces with farmers trying, because there is a huge drought situation, a massive drought, which really affected people's livelihood and health. Our teams have been working with them on legume production. So things are possible, very much possible. We just need some more enablers, some more continued attention, and some more support.
Tell me what the specific aspects of that enabling and support look like.
For example, if a community is in need, let's say a family needs vaccines, some COVID prevention commodities like soaps, for example. So the funding is available. There is an aid agency like CARE and others to deliver it. So what is the one thing which is needed? That we are able to go into that community and come back, we being safe and the community being safe. This is what I mean by humanitarian access. If this is interrupted by security or other factors, it means that the vulnerable people who urgently need aid will either the aid will be delayed or they will not be able to get it. So this is one of the biggest enablers, that humanitarian aid agencies must be able to deliver aid timely, safely, and uninterruptedly. And I cannot emphasize enough the importance of the banking sector and fuel and electricity availability. And without money, we will not be able to turn around this really, really imminent humanitarian catastrophe.
Can you say just one more word for us about the particular impact this is having on women and children?
Women and children are bearing the brunt of the crisis, the pandemic, the hunger situation. Majority of the people who have been forced to flee their homes, and usually it's not once, it is multiple times, it is women and children.
Deepmala Mehala, Vice President of Humanitarian Affairs for CARE. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back with you now on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Nationwide, only 4% of police chiefs are Black. But But since 2009, Chief Joel Fitzgerald has been top cop in four different cities. In each, he was the first Black officer to serve as chief. From 2015 to 2019, Fitzgerald served as chief of police in Fort Worth, Texas. He was fired the day he was scheduled to present the FBI with evidence of corruption in the city. Fitzgerald says he was offered a large severance if he agreed not to talk publicly. He refused. And in May 2019, a Texas state appeals panel ruled that Fitzgerald's performance was not the cause of his termination. The panel indicated he should have been honorably discharged. 1 year after this ruling, in June 2020, Chief Fitzgerald began his new job as chief of police in Waterloo, Iowa. Every year since 2018, Waterloo, Iowa has been ranked among the top five worst places to live for African Americans, according to an annual report by the website Wall Street 24/7. The rankings are based on measures like Black median income, unemployment, and home ownership rates. Fitzgerald started in Waterloo just days after Officer Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd in Minneapolis. It was a police slaying that touched off historic protests around the world, including in Waterloo. Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! Fitzgerald told me about this tough beginning.
Change making was something that was necessary. My first day interacting with the community here in Waterloo was during the George Floyd protest. I was to be, sworn in on June the 1st, and the evening before, I was out with the mayor and a crowd of about 200 to 300 people, just talking and having those difficult conversations with members of the community that were frustrated with the lack of change and the need for reform in law enforcement.
The activism and organizing of the movement for Black Lives accelerated calls for police reform at precisely the moment Fitzgerald assumed leadership of the Waterloo Police. And he told me that careful listening to community concerns and meaningful reform of policing practices have guided his choices in Waterloo.
When I got here, that change had to happen. I had to sit down with some of my staff members and some of the rank and file and work on things like use of force, the duty to report, the duty to intervene, bias-based policing, and other items that have come up, like no chokeholds, things that were brought up even during the Eight Can't Wait movement that we addressed very early on as a part of our promise to the individuals out there that were protesting. And I vowed to them that we would investigate every complaint, that we would promote change within the department, that we would create reforms that were born out of some of the ideas and some of the principles that people shared with me.
One of the first issues Black people in the city brought to Chief Fitzgerald was the police department's emblem. You see, it's an image of a winged griffin adopted in the 1960s. And for decades, Black Waterloo residents have noticed that the mythical half-eagle, half-lion creature also bears a very close resemblance to the KKK dragon. Here's a Black community organizer in Waterloo addressing the chief directly about the logo during a protest back in June of 2020.
How can we respect y'all when you wear that? How can we respect y'all when you ride through our community? They don't serve. They don't protect. It's bad.
It has been something that has been a powder keg for this community, and that has been changed. It was changed as a result of council vote, and as we speak, there's a transition happening where the patch is being removed and being replaced with a new patch that is, something that the community in and of itself can stomach. And if any member or any segment of a community is offended by something that law enforcement's doing, our job is to ensure that we first clarify our position, and second, we try to adapt and make the department something that is representative of everyone in the community.
In a move that is more than a bit unusual for law enforcement, Chief Fitzgerald has granted interviews to numerous media outlets in recent weeks. Here's what he told me about the reasons he is speaking out publicly about his frustrations with his experiences in Waterloo.
The racial microaggressions that I've experienced here, the propaganda that's been put out on certain websites in reference to just changing the patch and questioning your leadership and just certain intangibles. You know, it seems as if, you know, we as Black police chiefs are subjected to a different sliding scale sometimes when you have the experience, you have the education, you are you're a change agent, you're a person that brings, you know, about community change, and you get criticized for it.
It's remarkable to hear a police officer point to the injustice of racial profiling, especially considering that unfair scrutiny of Black people and communities on the basis of race is precisely the concern motivating efforts to reform or abolish American policing. According to research published in the Stanford Social Innovation Review, of the 2,400 elected prosecutors in the United States, the vast majority are white, male, and approximately 85% of them, they run unopposed for their office. So, when Kim Fox was elected state's attorney in Cook County, Illinois in 2016, she made history as the first Black woman to serve as lead prosecutor in the city of Chicago. And race and gender are not the only things that distinguish Fox from her counterparts. She ran on a platform of sweeping criminal justice reform. Now, her work earned her broad support within the Black community and re-election in 2020. And it attracted racist, sexist backlash. I spoke with Fox last month during an event for the Vera Institute of Justice. And here's what she recounted.
I had racists march on my office. The Proud Boys, members of QAnon, and the Fraternal Order of Police all gathered together and marched on my office because they didn't like that I dropped charges on a celebrity for what would otherwise in any other place be a misdemeanor. This happened where people literally were taking my photo and rubbing my picture on their genitalia outside of the chief prosecutor's office in the city of Chicago, and the press didn't talk about them.
For more on the challenges facing Black law enforcement officials who are creating change from the inside out, we're joined now by Roy Austin, former Department of Justice and Obama White House official. Mr. Austin, great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you so much, Melissa.
And also with us is Paul Butler, the Albert Brick Professor at Law at Georgetown University, former prosecutor and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Professor Butler, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Melissa, it's great to be back on The Takeaway.
So I want to begin with you, Professor Butler. Remind us of some of the most common types of reforms that are, in fact, being implemented over maybe the past year or two in law enforcement across the U.S.
Melissa, people of color have been demanding police reform since U.S. police departments evolved or devolved from slave patrols. And police reform has been about combating violence by law enforcement officers, racial profiling, and selective prosecution of people of color for things like drug crimes. And so reform has centered on transparency and accountability. Specifically, now there's been a lot of focus on ending no-knock warrants, which is how Breonna Taylor got killed, getting rid of chokeholds, which are infamous after the news of the last year that inspired the protests about George Floyd. So it's about specific steps that departments can take to make themselves more effective at delivering their services to the community.
So, Mr. Austin, one of the things I want to engage with you here is that in that long push, right, sort of that, if we, again, you know, from slave patrols forward, right, these many, many, many decades of effort, for so long, they had been happening only from the outside in. But now there's also this effort to put into places like, you know, police chiefs or prosecutors, people who themselves are reformers from the inside out. How's that working for those inside out reformers?
You know, it's a tough slog. They are changing the way we look at justice in this country. And for a lot of people, there's only one form of justice, and that is for people of color, lock them up for as long as you possibly can. There's a realization that that hasn't worked, that has not made anybody more safe. It has destroyed communities and families. And so these reformers are coming in, changing the way the old guard gets to do its business, and they are being attacked for doing so.
Paul, given what Roy is telling us here about the that when you are on the inside of the system trying to do this work to change it, that the attacks come, you know, there's not the same kind of respect for the office and the institution, right? The racialization of the people and the racial engendered nature of the people in those roles so frequently leads to these kinds of attacks. Is that part of why some folks say you can't reform these systems, can't reform the police, have to abolish it?
I think that's right, Melissa, and I'm so glad you brought up gender, because in this instance, we have to think about intersectionality. Kim Fox's experience in Chicago is not unique. African-American women elected prosecutors have had it far worse than anybody else, including white male progressive prosecutors. And so I do think the focus has to be on changing the culture. The Obama Commission on 21st Century Policing talked about changing the culture from warrior mindsets, which too many departments have now, to guardians. And if you think about it, the person who applies for a job as a warrior has a whole different set of skills and experiences and objectives than the person who wants to be a guardian. And in order to transform policing, some folks have said reform is too limited. It's too unambitious, given the scale of the problem.
Roy, even in the role of guardian, though, doesn't it matter who you're guarding? I'm thinking here of lynch mobs who understood themselves as guardians of white women's virtue, and the violence over and against Black men wasn't any different than a warrior mindset.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned respect, and we saw this with Obama. People used to say you have to respect the presidency, and then President Obama came in and you had all these people disrespecting it. Same thing is happening with these Black men and women, especially prosecutors. They're there, and suddenly everybody forgets that you're supposed to respect the institution, respect their discretion. It's just not happening because, again, they are changing the lens with which you look at justice. And a lot of people are very uncomfortable with that because they've only seen justice from the lens of protecting wealthy white communities.
Okay, Roy, can you tell me a little bit more about prosecutorial discretion, what it is and what's been happening with Black women prosecutors who've tried to use it?
Yeah, so prosecutors are largely allowed to decide, because they can't prosecute every single thing that comes in front of them, to decide what they're going to emphasize, what they're not going to emphasize, how they're going to run their office. They're elected to do so. And for as long as I remember, when you had white male prosecutors predominating, they were allowed to exercise their discretion. Well, suddenly you have these Black females and other reform-minded prosecutors in there, and everyone's trying to limit their discretion. And we saw it first, I first saw it with Aramis Ayala, who was trying to limit the use of the death penalty. And she got threatened. Actually, they took away all of her capital homicide cases because they decided that she could not exercise her discretion as a Black woman prosecutor.
Who's the they in this case?
You know, the they is actually, it's a big they. The they is the media. The they is other prosecutors in Florida for Aramis Ayala. The they is the police. The they is everybody but the voters. Because one thing you will notice is that these reform-minded prosecutors, when they run again, are being overwhelmingly reelected. But the they is the people in power who are not the people who are the voters.
Paul, yesterday we heard from Capitol Hill that the bipartisan effort to work on policing reform has hit what looks like an impasse, that it can't move past. That's at least what Senator Cory Booker is saying. And the issue is qualified immunity. Can you talk a little bit, remind our audience what qualified immunity is, and is there any hope of us ever moving past that impasse?
Qualified immunity is the idea you can't sue me because I'm a cop. It's a doctrine that was invented by the Supreme Court to protect police officers from personal liability. But Melissa, here's the thing. The Democrats were willing to compromise to an extent on qualified immunity, but that still wasn't enough for the Republicans in the Senate, who are staunchly against any kind of police reform. They wouldn't even go as far as President Trump went in his executive order last year after George Floyd was murdered.
So it's interesting to me, Paul, because there certainly was a bipartisan effort around not policing reform, but around incarceration reform. And it was, you know, largely based on a kind of, you know, libertarian ethic within aspects of the Republican Party, and also just a budget hawkishness, right? Just how expensive it is. So why is policing so different than incarceration in terms of the ability to get any kind of bipartisan work going on it?
There are a lot of people to blame for the failure of politicians to respond to this moment. The New York Times says that the protests last year about police reform were the largest social justice movement in the history of the United States. Everybody knows about the infamy of January 6th. Well, last year on June 6th, there were protests about policing in 500 different American cities. There's never been a social justice movement that's had that reach. And one of the organizations that's standing in the way is police unions, Melissa. They oppose almost every effort by activists and citizens for accountability and transparency because they believe it's, I guess, good for their jobs. But the thing is, if police aren't respected and trusted by the people who they're supposed to serve and protect, they're not able to do their jobs as well. So at the end of the day, reform is about public safety.
Roy, we've been talking here a little bit about these intersections of gender, race, and reform-mindedness. And I just feel like maybe it's worth sort of talking about the ways that race and gender don't necessarily mean reform-mindedness, that a Black woman police chief or a, you know, Black male sheriff might or might not be reformers. As you kind of look across the country, where do you see the intersection of all three? Where are the folks who have themselves sort of these intersectional identities and are deeply committed to reform?
So where, you know, where I see it is in St. Louis with Kim Gardner, Chicago, Kim Fox, Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore. You know, what you just spoke of, though, was what happened in the race in L.A., where in L.A., a Black female non-reformer was beat by a Latino male reformer. And of course, now he's caught up in some of this recall nonsense that is sweeping California. So you see the intersectionality now because you're finally having intersectional prosecutors who are running for office and are winning office. And we are seeing more and more chiefs of color. You know, we should be looking closely at Charlottesville right now. There's some nonsense happening there where a Black female chief was pushed out. Really, it seems like some nonsense being led by the union there, the police fraternal organization. So it doesn't stop. And luckily, there are people out there who are fighting for these chiefs and fighting for reform and fighting for fairness and justice around the country.
So, Paul, on Roy's point, and then also connecting back to yours about the big protests. So if you are not an insider, if you're an outsider, you're trying to get reform, maybe you've gotten a Kim Fox elected to office over an Anita Alvarez, maybe you've gotten a Kim Gardner elected. How do you simultaneously, from the outside, hold accountable these reformers, but also help to protect them from these powerful forces like police unions that want to push them out?
First of all, you have to have everyone understand that when these African-American women take these brave steps, like in Maryland, Marilyn Mosby is not prosecuting sex workers. She's not prosecuting drug addicts because she understands that that's not in the interest of her community. You have to protect them, not just politically, but you have to understand that with issues like bail reform, every now and then there's going to be some case that's in the news that will be used to attack these prosecutors. And folks have to defend them. They have to step up for them. Because, again, it's not just about a kumbaya racial justice equity thing. It's about family and community safety and wholeness. If people are invested in the cops, if people believe and trust their prosecutors, we have better outcomes, and that makes all of us safer.
Paul Butler is the Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University, former prosecutor and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. And Roy Austin is a former Department of Justice and White House official. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Always a pleasure.
Well, that's all we have for y'all today. I can't believe it's Thursday. This week is just flying by. Thanks for being here with us. Before we go, we'd like to send our love and our condolences to the family of the late, great Melvin Van Peebles. Van Peebles is known as the godfather of black cinema. His work in film, music, and theater has exerted tremendous influence over generations of American artists.
I want in that now you have women directing films and no one even begins to think about. You have Latinos, you have Asians, you have blacks, you have disenfranchised across the board being able to do things that I made possible. That's what I wanted to do.
The legend died on Tuesday at the age of 89. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Come on back tomorrow. It's Politics Day.